Okay, so first of all, I want to thank everyone for being on the call today. The topic of this conversation is about making tough decisions about problem employees. You know, essentially, do I keep them and train them, or do I let them go? But the bigger picture here is how to prevent employee issues from arising in the first place, or about mitigating the harm when issues do arise. And that really is, you know, essentially about, you know, preventative and proactive HR versus reactive HR. I want you all to know that you should all have received via email at this point Chuck's PDF handout. It really is like the bottom line essence of those kind of big picture questions. And I highly recommend reviewing it immediately after the teleseminar ends. Chuck, do you want to say a little bit about yourself before we begin?
Sure. I'm a management side labor and employment attorney and human resources counselor. So I work with companies, predominantly small to medium-sized businesses, resolving HR issues, policy and practice development, contentious employee issues, things like that, and all the way through from the proactive HR or problem solving at the beginning or the genesis of the problem, all the way through to litigation or reactive type stuff. So representation before regulatory agencies or litigation in court. And my approach, by the way, you know, as an attorney, and any of you could correct me on this during the call, I tend to be a little cynical. So, you know, I kind of, you know, I think some I get too caught in my own mindset regarding, well, just fire them. I mean, if they're causing that much problem, you know, that many problems, just fire them. But in all honesty, I try to check myself and make sure that I'm thinking in terms of the bottom line cost, that usually it's better to try to rehab a problem employee than just outright fire them. So.
Excellent. And let me just share a little bit about myself. My expertise as a certified professional coach is in, you know, helping you engage your employees to be more productive, effective, and easier to work with. This tends to take on names like leadership development or management training or team building, but in essence, it's about coaching you to be the kind of person your employees want to listen to. And if they want to listen to you, then, you know, they're more willing to take a different set of actions than they would have done ordinarily. And that's really the key, in my opinion, to employee effectiveness. And, you know, that's something that we're going to be touching on today. And so, like I was saying, the focus of today's presentation is on making tough decisions about problem employees. But again, the bigger picture is about how do you prevent employee issues from arising? How do you mitigate the harm when issues do arise? And the goal essentially is to retain valued performers while replacing poor ones. Now, sometimes the decision to let someone go is easier than at other times. Like if you've got a white male grouch who doesn't work well with others, who shows up late, who hasn't ever done good work, it's much easier to choose to let that person go. You know, in contrast, you know, you can, you know, actually this isn't in contrast. Let me give another example where this might be a little easier. You can have a situation where a single salesperson hasn't pulled in her quota for 6 months, and, you know, with her base pay, it actually costs more to have her on your staff. Or maybe you had someone violate the code of conduct. There are obviously lots of permutations for easy situations. So what I'm going to focus on isn't so much about what do you do in easy situations, but what do you do with the harder ones? How do you make the harder decisions? And the first place we want to go to look at is what's making the decision tough. You know, when you have an issue arising with an employee, what's making it a tough decision? Is it that you're afraid of legal repercussions, like maybe you're concerned about a discrimination lawsuit? Is it that they're high performing in some ways and low performing in other ways? So, for instance, maybe they do great work alone, but they don't get along well with others, or they have a really great attitude but poor core skills. You know, is it tough because you've got someone who had a record of stellar past performance and somewhere along the line that turns sour? Is it that the person you're thinking of is hard to replace? Is there an office politics or like a protection element? Like, is it, you know, are you talking about the founder's brother or an executive's niece? Is there an emotional element to it? You know, is it hard to fire people you care about? Maybe they're really nice, or you've worked with them for a long time. It's hard to let those kind of people go. So those are just six different reasons why the decision could be a tough one. There are obviously many more reasons. But at the core, the problem of deciding whether to fire or train or do nothing is cost-benefit analysis. But here's the thing, you know, you may have taken an economics class and learned, oh, you know, cost-benefit analysis, it's very cut and dry. You list the costs on one column, you list the benefits on the other. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to do that kind of exercise. But here's the thing, you're talking about a fundamental issue between humans here, and cost-benefit analysis is rarely cut and dry when you're dealing with people's livelihoods. So it's normal to have these be tough decisions. They absolutely can be very hard. And so what we got to do to the best of our ability is sort out how can we make it easier? How can we make it easier? What's really going on over here? Now, it's an easier decision to make when you've got quantitative data on hand. But there's also qualitative data. And what I'd like to walk you through today is a bit of a process for how to make that decision and how to put some measurements on fuzzy areas so you can come out saying, okay, this person needs to go, or okay, we're going to invest in this person further, or okay, these are the changes we're going to make this to resolve this situation here and across the company, because this is actually a company-wide issue. So here are the questions you want to start asking when you're dealing with difficult employees. First, you want to establish what's really going on. So that means getting clear on what's happening. It means getting the relevant facts, getting the opinions, but it's also about making sure that you keep them separate so that you can clearly distinguish, okay, this is the stuff that's actually happening, and these are people's interpretations or opinions about what's really going on. So here are the areas where you want to look. You want to look at personal skills. You want to look at a person's attitude. You want to look at the impact they have on others, the team, customers, colleagues, vendors. You want to look at your company culture. And those are the areas where you can get facts. And then on the flip side, you've got the opinions and the interpretations, you know, the explanations for why this can be happening. So that might be, you know, so here are six different kinds of interpretations about why this can be happening. You know, you might have temporary personal life issues. Now, when I say temporary, I do not necessarily mean short term. Sometimes, you know, a person can be going through a temporary life issue that takes them 6 months to a year to resolve. Or it can be an ugly divorce, and that can take years. You know, somebody's default behavior patterns. That could be an explanation for why something is coming up and causing problems. You can have lack of communication around expectations, so they're not tuned into how they're doing, and there's no regular conversation about why a difficult employee is doing what they're doing and how to make it better. Now, I want to distinguish that from an annual performance review. There's, you know, when you're talking to someone on a yearly basis or on a, you know, twice a year basis about, you know, how they're doing, that doesn't really get them in touch with the day-to-day concerns about what's working and what's not working. Why else could this be happening? Here's a fourth reason. Maybe this person isn't a good fit for their current role. It could be interpersonal team issues, like not getting along with a particular person, or it could be communications breakdowns that lead to resentment or stress or hostility. Or it could be, you know, company-wide work environment issues. And here's a clue when you know that you're dealing with that. It's when other people are dealing with the same thing. So even though the problem of difficult employees may seem really bad, the solutions to some of these issues are simple. Chuck, is there anything else that you want to add about this?
Yeah, I think some of the a couple things to add is that there's no business that hires a person with the intent of just firing them, really, for poor performance or misconduct almost immediately. I mean, we hire employees because we need workers to perform a function for us to help us make money. Oftentimes, I think difficult employees tend to think the opposite, that, well, you just hired me to set me up. And they come to they have this conspiratorial sort of attitude regarding the company, the HR people, their supervisors, whatever. And I mean, in all honesty, how many of us have the time to actually design a conspiracy to get rid of a low performing or poorly behaving employee? So I mean, really, and what I try to explain to difficult employees is to be, or what I try to do is to be transparent about this, more or less saying everything I just said on this call over the last minute to the employee. We haven't hired you with the intent to fire you. You know, think about the logic of that. And if you believe that, then really, clearly, you're not a fit to probably work in any workplace. If all you're looking for is, if all you're paying attention to is fake conspiracies or some sort of delusional concept of what the company is, what you think the company is trying to do to you, then this isn't going to work out for us. And then you could start looking at the cost factors too. And I've had this discussion with difficult employees, such as unemployment compensation, how much is going to cost, you know, how much can we endure as a business relative to their unemployment compensation, to a lawsuit or a complaint, whatever. And more often than not, I find when having these discussions with employees, it really kind of opens their eyes up to these issues, to the issue of how difficult they are as an employee or as a person, how much trouble their supervisor is having with them, or how much trouble the company's having with them because of their behavior or performance. And I always differentiate, too, behavior and performance. To me, you could obviously have a very well-behaving employee who conducts themselves very professionally but is not a good performer, and you could have high-performing employees who don't behave very well. So, and you see this a lot, especially in the realm of politics, I think. But so I try to be transparent and get the employer, you know, the, one of the hot words these days is engage the employee in this sort of discussion. And then also just real quick to add, and this even translates to the logistics of having this discussion with an employee, like do you have them face the window? Do you try to have another person in the room with you, a witness? Do you have security on standby? Do you sit behind? I've never been one to sit behind a desk. I always believe that it's better to get out from behind a desk and to have a difficult conversation with an employee face-to-face with no obstacles in between you. Some people might worry about violence, but I know I've fired hundreds of people in my career, and I'm a white male, and I've never had any problems with violence or anybody threatening me. So my demeanor is always, when firing somebody or dealing with a difficult employee, is really the same as it is on this phone call. Go on.
No, that's really great. One of the things that you really hit on that I want to expand a little bit is not just, you know, when you're trying to get clear on what's going on, why is a difficult employee, behaving the way they're behaving, what's the issue with their performance, why are they a difficult employee? When you're separating the facts from the opinions, just recognize that, you know, the employee themselves, they have their own set of facts and opinions, and a lot of times the two are interrelated and unclear, and there's no real people don't learn in school to live the distinction facts versus opinions. I mean, they're certainly taught it, but when you have an employee who, you know, relates to their workplace like, you know, they're just trying to fire me, that's real for them. They really see that as something that's true about what's going on. It's real. It's a fact, even though it might not actually be the case. Even though it might not actually be a fact, they're relating to it as if it is. And so I just kind of want to point out that not only do you and your team and the people in the workplace have their own set of facts and opinions about what's going on with this difficult employee, but that employee does as well. And when you're not separating what's actually going on from what everyone's opinions are about what's going on, you tend to get into sticky situations. And Chuck, I think that's what you're alluding to, especially on the employee side. It's really some part of it is really dealing with their limiting belief about, you know, the company is out to get them. That only reinforces their resentment and their hostility toward the company. It actually takes away from them being effective.
Or a particular supervisor. Because I think what happens with middle management is you have that classic quandary of middle manager getting squeezed by both ends or squeezed in between both ends. The people at the top who want them to resolve the issue yesterday, and then the employees who they're supervising, who are they may be friends with, or they may have some emotional connection to otherwise, or they came from among their ranks themselves, and now they're getting blowback because of this middle management quandary of being sandwiched in between upper management and the rank and file workers, employees. And I think when a middle manager is transparent about that and explains to a difficult employee about that sort of issue, the quandary, the middle management quandary, that they're better able to get buy-in. And it's almost even saying, look, we need to gauge with you whether or not only can you work for us, but are you promotable? I mean, is this an environment that you can thrive in or help us, make more money? And if you're not interested in a promotion, are you at least being profitable for us?
Those are really excellent questions to ask. They actually are pointing to the kind of simple solutions you can implement that would really address these kind of difficult problems.
And just let me make clear, I'm saying, one of the things that I'm saying is to actually have this discussion with the problem employee. I've done investigations on harassment, discrimination, where I've had the supervisor who was accused or alleged to have been the harasser or the discriminator, I've actually had them in the room with us having this sort of discussion. And I've seen them move to tears. I've seen, it shows them, hey, they're putting out a lot of money to resolve this issue or to resolve this problem with me. If I don't take this seriously, I know I'm going to be gone soon. They're giving me a chance here. I better take this chance. Otherwise, that's it for my job.
I want to expand on that point within the context of it being a real solution. What Chuck is pointing to is one of the simplest solutions. It might not be the easiest, but it is certainly simple and effective. And that's having heart-to-heart conversations. Some people call them tough conversations or fierce conversations. But it's really having people get together to have a real conversation about what's going on, to talk about getting someone's side of the story, about opening yourself up and being vulnerable, communicating about expectations and consequences, possibly building a more flexible structure to help them perform better or to help them deal with whatever it is that they're dealing with. These are all, it seems kind of funny that in an environment that's highly professionalized, you'd want to have people open up and be vulnerable and actually, have a heart-to-heart, but that's what works because we're humans, and that's how humans work. That's how we are effective.
Well, I think it's a generational change, too.
Can you talk more about that?
I'm sorry?
Yeah, I think that's perfect. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I think I've dealt with companies who had the mindset of you watch Mad Men, you see the companies from the 1950s or 60s, and everything was the bottom line. And today, things have really, we've changed with the Internet. Everything seems to be more open, more transparent. We can find out more information about people than we've ever been able to before, by Googling them or by checking out their Facebook profiles, whatever. And I think we're in this transition to where we're just starting to understand how we need to conduct ourselves in these sort of media or mediums, modes of communication. And I think engaging employees in an open and honest way is kind of part of the transition from this sort of more hierarchical chain of command structure to a more engaged or involved employee and workplace environment, workplace culture. And I think that's really going to drive an increase. I think that, ultimately that's going to drive an increase in profits for business too. It's this change. We've seen it with, I hate these labels, but we've seen it with the baby boomers, Generation X, Generation Y, or what they call millennials. That they're more, everybody's got access to the Internet. They all have access to pretty much the same amount of information everyone else does. And how they use that information, what they do with it, that really is going to, I think, make a key difference in whether or not they're profitable to an employer.
That's really excellent. Let me just hone in on that point just a little bit more. It really is a question of effectiveness. How effective is it to have a kind of madman atmosphere at your work versus one where people are engaged and where they're able to share their feelings or to, you know, what some people consider the softer side, but is really the source of effectiveness when you have people getting together to do work together. And when it gets ignored, you know, you have resentment, hostility, bitterness, disappointment, all that stuff building up. It's got to get aired out.
Yeah.
And
let me just jump in real quick. You have to give them an outlet to vent. Because if they're not going to vent, if you don't give them an outlet to directly vent to you, they're going to vent to their attorney, to the EEOC, the National Labor Relations Board, or some other agency. So you got to pay attention to those issues, whether it's even gossip, to the effect that you're paying attention to gossip in the workplace, so you could jump on an issue right from the get-go.
We've received a couple of questions when we were busy putting together this teleseminar, and one of the biggest questions that we got, and it showed up in a lot of different ways, but it really, the essence of it was, how do I influence people to do something that they might not do autonomously? And, you know, when it showed up, like, how do I get my employee to do this, or how do I get my supervisor to have these kind of tough conversations, or whatever it is that involves, you know, convincing someone to do something they wouldn't ordinarily do. And I want to speak to that because I think that's at the heart of a successful heart-to-heart or tough conversation, is giving people empowering and engaging whoever you're talking to in such a way where they are open and ready and willing to take whatever actions you've discussed with them. Not so that you're twisting their arm, not so that they feel forced or manipulated, but that they are willingly open and ready to do whatever actions are there to do. And the secret to that, and if you get nothing else from this call, get the secret to having a successful heart-to-heart conversation. It's about getting an energetic buy-in. And when I'm talking about an energetic buy-in, I mean someone sees a new opportunity for them that wasn't there before the conversation started. That's different from convincing. When we talk about convincing someone in, you know, ordinary English, we're talking about, you know, how do I get someone to do something? And that's really not what an energetic buy-in is at all. An energetic buy-in is having someone become aware of the impact of whatever's going on in such a way where then they're moved to take action. It doesn't happen when they're getting yelled at or scolded or disciplined. It happens when there's open communication, when there's vulnerability, when there's real talk. And then they see stuff that they maybe hadn't seen before or hadn't even thought of before. They suddenly become aware of blind spots that, you know, weren't, you know, they couldn't even see that they couldn't see, or about issues that, you know, they weren't willing to address, but then as a result of the conversation, they can address. It's about getting people to shift energetically from a have to a want to. That's the secret to any heart-to-heart conversation. And it's how to influence people to get things done that they wouldn't have ordinarily gotten done. There's a whole lot more I can say about energetic buy-in, but I'll really just keep it to that, to the essence of what it is. You know, I'll just ask you to take a moment, think back to the kind, you know, to the last effective conversation you had with someone. Maybe it was, you know, like a family member who wasn't open to doing something at all, but then once you really kind of opened up and talked about it, they really actually became open to it, and it didn't come out of you forcing them to do it. It's the same principles that apply in human behavior everywhere, and they're going to apply to these kind of situations with difficult employees as well. Now, as we're going through these kind of solutions, I want you to know heart-to-heart conversations are like the linchpin of anything. They're the linchpin of human effectiveness. And I do want you to be aware of the costs and the benefits of a solution that's just a heart-to-heart conversation. So first of all, these kind of conversations, you know, they cost a manager's time. And, you know, you might need to train your managers to deliver these kind of conversations effectively, because these kind of conversations are not taught in management school, and they're certainly not taught in, you know, the standard education that we all go through over the course of our childhoods. But the benefit is, when it's done properly, it clears the air and it enable something else to be possible that wasn't possible before. Now, how effective are these kind of conversations? Well, that's going to depend on the manager's skills, and it's going to require ongoing, frequent attention. You know, sometimes it works that you can have one conversation and all of the issues disappear, but if you're going to assume that that's always going to be the case, then reality isn't going to be a pleasant one.
Yeah.
Do you want to say more about that?
Yeah, actually, yeah, because I think you're hitting on something that's really important. Where do you draw the line? I mean, you know, you can't – obviously, if you have a problem employee, you can't have them running to your office or running to you or a supervisor, you know, once a day or twice, three times a week with talking about the same issues. And really, you have to kind of gauge that, hey, we've crossed the line now. You're not – we can't rehab you. We can't remediate you. We can't improve you. Whether it's – maybe it's our fault. Maybe we're just not or, you know, maybe we're just not a good fit for you. And we're just going to have to let you go because of that. So I think at some point you have to really gauge, you know, how much manpower, time, money, effort do we want to put into this rehabbing or remediation sort of program versus just calling it quits and getting somebody new.
Yeah. We're talking about this in the context of difficult employees, but this really applies to any employee, even high-performing ones. You know, if you're going to have the door open to have open and vulnerable conversations, there's a certain level of commitment to that. And that actually dovetails in with the next kind of solution, which is, you know, you need some kind of ongoing frequent attention, but how much of that is too much? What works? How can you create support structures for people that are independent of the manager being the point person for everything? That leads into the next kind of solution, which is to offer in-house or external programs to assist the employee in whatever it is that they're dealing with. It could be counseling for grieving or substance abuse, or it could be other big personal issues. You may want to recommend that they do certain external training programs. You may direct them to some kind of counseling. It's really situation specific. The cost of that to the company is going to be highly dependent on your insurance, on the structure of your company, on the kind of program you're looking for. But just to ballpark a cost, you're looking at $100 to $200 an hour with an external professional counselor. The benefit is you've got the short-term alleviation of stress. In the medium term, you're looking at an increased individual performance because the person who can start airing their grievances is going to be performing at a higher level. And then long-term, you're looking at the loyalty and stability of that person. If they know they're getting cared for, they're not going to look somewhere else for, oh, you know, should I switch jobs? Should I worry about this? They're going to be loyal. They're going to be stable. Now, how effective are these kind of in-house or external training or counseling programs? That really depends on the level of buy-in, and that's why this gets paired with having a heart-to-heart conversation. If a person is really bought into getting counseled or to having an external support, they're obviously going to get a lot more out of it than if some person is forced to do it or if they are resisting it, but they have to in order to keep the job. The flip side of this is offering not necessarily counseling programs, but leadership-oriented programs to develop specific valuable employees. So this would be more along the lines of coaching on interpersonal skills or attitudes. This might be if you have a person who's a top performer, but they're a difficult or problem employee because they don't get along well with others, or they're a liability from maybe a sexual harassment point of view. You're looking at $5,000 to $10,000 over 6 to 12 months per person to develop a set of leadership-oriented interpersonal skills. And I'm speaking specifically to our programs at the Roundwell, that's what something like that would cost. The benefits are you're looking at short-term alleviating stress at the workplace. You're looking at a person's increased openness to look at ideas, to take on commitments that they haven't taken on in the past. Medium term, you're looking at an increased individual performance. You're looking at a person being able to work with purpose, higher engagement and energy to collaborate with others. And it's all as a result of having focused them on whatever interpersonal barriers were impacting them and then dissolving those barriers. Long term, again, you're looking at loyalty and stability. You're really looking at the transformation of a person's self from a problem employee to a high potential employee, or from a liability to an asset. And the effectiveness of this is, again, it depends on the level of buy-in, and that's why this gets paired with a heart-to-heart as well. Here's what leadership-oriented programs or interpersonal training programs, they're really effective. They're really effective in identifying whether an employee is willing to shift themselves so that they can fit in your organization or whether it's time for them to go. If you've got a manager or an executive who is high-performing, and you're paying, $150,000 to have them on payroll, and you put $10,000 into their training over 6 months or 12 months, and then you find out, hey, they're not really willing to change all that much. There's still a liability. Well, then you have more information upon which you can say, hey, you know what? We're going to end this relationship. This really isn't working out for us.
Okay, I'd like to jump in with a real world example too.
Sure, go right ahead.
This just came into the media, into our attention over the last few days. What happened in Afghanistan recently over the weekend with that one soldier who went berserk and killed 16 women and children. Now they're thinking that they're speculating that alcohol may play a part in it, or that some sort of post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury may have played a part in it, or alcohol and all these different combinations. I mean, to me, we don't know what the exact cause was yet, but when you look at workplace violence, I mean, I personally, as a manager or business owner, I'd much rather have my employees coming to me to talk about these issues than to have it explode the way it did in Afghanistan recently. And that type of stuff happens in that's how we got the whole cliche about going postal. That post office workers would, get pissed off about something and then come back to work the next day with a gun and start blowing people away. Or some little issue or dispute that was the last straw. And you're trying to avoid that, getting to that point of the last straw. So, and I I've even said to employees, hey, I need to make sure that you're not going to go postal or get violent on us. I need to know that, your behavior recently has been so deplorable that you're scaring the heck out of us. So
that's,
I think that's part of the transparency and part of the discussion that needs to be had. Is more often than not, I see supervisors, managers, practitioners who hedge away from having those discussions, and they'll say, well, then you end up with problems like, well, let us pray together. That's something that just came up in a case recently I saw with, I don't remember what business it was, but where the manager said, let us pray together. And, let's face it, you don't want to bring that type of religion into the workplace or use that as a problem-solving technique when the person or other people may be – when that person or others might be offended by it.
Yeah, and so the solution to that is really about having one-on-one honest conversations with whoever the problem employee is, whether they're a supervisor, a manager, whether they're, a frontline staff. It's training them or offering whatever support you think is necessary. And then obviously, contrasting that with, the amount of value they're bringing to the company. One other solution that you might want to consider is putting that person in a role that matches their skill set. Let me give you an example. A lot of times you've got, this is especially the case in the IT world, where, you might have somebody who's a great programmer, instead of the IT world, let's go into the sales world. Somebody who's a great salesperson and who does really well with sales, and then they get promoted to sales manager or sales director, and they have an entirely different set of accountabilities and responsibilities, and they don't do as hot. And that's because they're in a different job. Now, and that new role, that new job might not match their skill sets in the same way that their previous work did. Now, you could talk
It could also be a change in personnel too.
Sure.
Whether assigned to somebody new or there's a new management structure that's in place.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, when you're looking at putting them in a role that matches their skill set, and you can talk to us about specific assessments in this area, but the cost of being able to create that match is, first of all, there's the cost of an assessment. And then there's the possible replacement cost. I mean, if you're going to move someone from a position as a frontline salesperson to a sales manager, do you need to hire a new salesperson? And you may, depending on the success of this kind of endeavor, And I've found that this kind of work is very, very successful. When you can put the right people in the right jobs, there's just, you know, long term, there's like an explosion in performance. You may end up wanting to deliver the assessments across the board in your organization and then restructuring accordingly. Now, the benefit is you got a better organizational fit that's going to reduce frustration, that's going to increase individual performance, possibly team performance, and something that's extraordinarily effective over time. And again, this is kind of a bigger picture solution about, you know, why is this person a problem employee? Are they in the right place? You know, maybe they, and this is a great example that my partner had encountered when she was a project manager. She was given a problem employee to work with, and this person was really brilliant, really, really brilliant, but just did not work well with others, and none of the other managers could figure out what to do with this guy. So what she eventually came up with was, you know, I'm going to give him this kind of role and this kind of these kind of tasks so that he's going to kind of be self-sufficient. He's not going to really work with the team. More of his work is going to be individual-related work. And then the guy exploded as a star performer because he was put into an environment that supported his skill sets and his attitudes. It just really worked for him. So, again, you want, that's part of the questions you want to look at when you're putting people in the right roles. Next solution is to build high-performance teams. Now, this is if the issue isn't actually with a specific employee, but more likely with a low-performing or high-potential team. And in this kind of situation, you know, you're examining the issues of the problem employee, and you kind of realize, well, wow, this really isn't a single problem employee. This is endemic to the manager or the manager's past performance, or endemic to this particular team with its personalities or the way that it's structured. So the cost of building a high-performance team, you know, that can range from one on-site training day, which, you know, maybe $1.5 to $3,000, to off-site multiple days with or without lodging, and then you're talking about, you know, Boku bucks. You might have on-site multi-week program with a reinforcement mechanism, which, you know, would cost you over $10,000. And again, I'm ballparking the figure so that you get a sense of cost and scope here. The benefit is when you have a high-performing team, you're adding up the individual differences in performance and the effect on company's productivity. It means, you know, they're staying on schedule. There's, you know, less variance in their performance. There's an increase in their performance. You know, you're decreasing the tension in the group. These kind of solutions are appropriate, like I said, for low-performing, high-potential teams. And the effect is, you know, how effective they are. I mean, the bottom line is, you know, you want to have programs that are going to support the continual reinforcement of high-performance teams. If you want effective team building to get people to perform at their peak, it's not going to be a one-off solution. You do need to be meeting with them on a regular basis or putting them in some kind of training program that interacts with them on a regular basis so that they're really grounded in the distinctions that are going to enable them to perform at their peak.
I think
Chuck, is there anything you want to say about that?
Yeah, I think context is going to be key too, because obviously one of the callers I know is they're engaging consumer product manufacturing like soaps, deodorants, things like that. So, obviously, I mean, I don't think it's going to be beneficial to have very high conceptual or high concept sort of team building in that sort of environment. It might be more bottom line oriented, and you may want to engage in something simpler or to keep it very simple and engage in employee recognition programs or something along those lines to keep them engaged and to keep them happy, or to basically just stay out of their way, too. I mean, sometimes with some employees, they really just want supervisors and managers to stay out of their way and let them do their work. And you have to be able to, I think effective supervisors and managers really need to be able to identify that. Is this somebody that, especially if I'm a micromanager, I'm not personally a micromanager, but if I'm a micromanager as a supervisor, do I want somebody who's doesn't like to be micromanaged as an employee? And I think you have to be able to identify those sorts of issues and identify also whether or not a high concept sort of training program is something that's really going to be beneficial from a cost-benefit analysis in our workplace. You know, obviously, you don't want to engage in training that's over people's heads, so don't engage in that sort of training if you think it's going to go over the employees' heads.
Absolutely. And you also want to have the training fit the team. I mean, the kind of training that, you know, training for effective team building might be really, really great for your marketing people or for your salespeople or for your executive team, maybe more of the back end kind of work, versus, you know, the people who are on the floor, on the front lines. That's when, you know, an employee recognition program might be more appropriate, or where you want to have a team building that, you know, that, well, not really team building, but more of an organizational culture shift where you're looking at top-down changes. And when you can raise the level of engagement in your higher levels with your executive team, they can start being more attentive to the employees' needs, and that's where you get these kind of employee recognition programs filtering down or anything else that is more considerate of what is going to have the employees be more effective.
And also I think you have to be cognizant of some of the blowback or what happens with employees when you start engaging these types of programs, whether it's training, recognition, whatever, is that employees are going to think that, well, and a lot of managers think this too, that we have to treat everybody exactly the same. And that's not true. I mean, nobody gets treated exactly the same at the workplace. Higher performers tend to make more money if it's piece labor or if it's commission-based, bonus-based type of salary structure. Better performers don't get fired. Better behaving employees sometimes don't get fired either than worse behaving employees. So you have to kind of get beyond the idea that don't we have to treat all employees the same? And the answer is no. The basic idea is that you have to treat them the same regardless of, you know, any of the protected classes, race, gender, national origin, military status. So you have to kind of avoid, you have to avoid any actions which can be perceived as being discriminatory on the basis of a protected class. And generally what happens with difficult employees is that they're always going to place themselves in the context of a protected class. And then basically if they're not willing to move back from that, you're going to know if you're worth your weight as a supervisor or manager, you should be able to identify whether or not a person can move away from that sort of defensiveness, that sort of attitude about being a member of protected class that's being discriminated against versus somebody who's, you know, this has nothing to do with me being a protected class. This is really just about my behavior towards my supervisors, towards my coworkers, towards the company in general. It's about morale, performance, and profit.
Excellent. There's one other thing that I want to touch on before I turn the presentation over to you, Chuck, and that's about organizational culture. Here's the thing about organizational culture. You may have a difficult employee or a problem employee, and they're behaving in a certain way, but then it actually turns out that historically your company has a lot of this coming up. You can actually see this there's an investment banking firm that one of the high-level executives just left the company and released an op-ed in, I think it's the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, and they talked about how the culture has deteriorated so that they don't care about people anymore. They don't care about their customers. They're just looking at taking advantage of their customers and, you know, increasing their bottom line. And how effective is that as an organizational culture? You know, if you have problem employees and they're showing up across the board, maybe there's something in the organizational culture that's coming up that needs to be addressed. And that, you know, so when you're inquiring into shifting your organizational culture in a way that might lead to an overall program, this is obviously not an appropriate response to a one employee dilemma. But you do want to see a one employee dilemma in a larger context of, you know, how often does this come up in the company? Is there something that needs to shift about our hiring practices? Is there something that needs to shift in the way that we're treating our people? And that kind of dovetails with coaching managers to give consistent, straightforward, honest, frequent feedback and about having them communicate that up. I mean, if you've got a chain of people who are in open communication with each other about what's going on, you'll be able to spot these problems a lot easier. Chuck, I'll turn it over to you.
Sure. All right. Some of the legal considerations I've already touched on, obviously the protected class issues. Something that comes up a lot is documentation. And I was just out at a client's work site a couple days ago. It's an auto body shop in Chicago. They're being sued for a Fair Labor Standards Act violation. And I met with the owner of the body shop and his accountant, and they asked me about performance appraisals, evaluations. Can we, you know, do you have forms for that? And I looked around the body shop. I'm like, you know, it's full of cars that are in state of disrepair. And I looked, you know, I looked at the employees who were there. There's like four employees. They're just basically, you know, I don't want to sound derogatory, but they're working, you know, sort of like grease monkeys. I mean, they're working in and around an environment that's not structured. There's a lot of dirt. And I said to them, like, have you ever used performance appraisals, or have you ever had these issues before you needed to document stuff? And he's like, and the owner was like, no. I'm like, well, you know, I don't think we really need to get into that then, into the documentation and all that. You have one problem employee who filed a lawsuit against you, but the fact of the matter was this problem employee never came to you prior to the lawsuit regarding these issues. So maybe the problem isn't the employee so much as it's the employee's attorney. And really that's what it's going to come down to, I think, in this Fair Labor Standards Act violation or alleged violation case. It's not so much that it was the employee themselves, but it was the employee's attorney who's looking for, you know, their cut of it. So I think you kind of have to recognize that sometimes these aren't just soft issues in terms of personality, attitude, character, but also that there's other factors at play here. There could be a zealous or overzealous investigator from a state unemployment compensation office. I've seen that come up a lot where you have people at in various state offices, whether it's – I just had one recently resolved in New York where basically it was a difficult employee who filed for unemployment compensation because they felt that they should have been not an independent contractor but an employee and should have been treated as such. And then the state unemployment compensation office comes down with their edict saying that, well, you misclassified this employee, so now you owe us for back taxes. And I've seen this, these types of disputes mushroom. More often, I think they mushroom because of ignorance more than anything else. Ultimately, the penalty that the company had to pay was about $500. So, you know, why should everybody get in an uproar over $500? Just come clean about the misclassification. Let's just move beyond that. Obviously, if the back taxes or penalties would have been really substantial, I'm talking about, you know, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, then we're getting into a little bit different context there, and it might be better or more beneficial for the company than to actually defend its position legally or in a court of law or before a regulatory agency than it is to just, you know, pay the ticket and be on your way. So I think those are some of the parameters that need to be looked at relative to dealing with these sorts of issues. Ultimately, how much money will this cost us versus how much money will we save by just firing the person or by trying to rehab or train them? Excuse me.
What are some of the unexpected things that can come up for people who are looking to let go of their employees?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I see come up a lot is you have these policies and practices in the workplace that aren't adhered to or aren't followed. And when you start diverging away from policy and practice, people are going to start taking notice, and it's going to be like, well, why all of a sudden, you know, everybody has been treated in this one fashion, and now all of a sudden we're being treated I'm being treated in a completely different fashion. You see this come up too a lot with documentation. People talk about documenting everything. Well, it's impossible to document everything. If it were possible to document everything, then there probably wouldn't be any litigation over contracts. There wouldn't be any contract disputes or divorce disputes, things like that. So you have to kind of come clean about documentation. That's impossible to document everything. If we're going to engage in documentation, then let's not divert from policy. Let's engage in it to the fullest extent that we believe we have to, or to the fullest extent under law, and not mess around with just, you know, paying so much attention to one employee that everybody else we're not paying the same sort of attention to or scrutinizing in the same respect. And sometimes that's going to lead to the protected class sort of dispute where, well, you didn't document everything with John the same way you've documented with me. And why, you know, where's the difference? And that's also where the transparency comes in terms of explaining to an employee why we've taken more exhaustive steps with you than we have with John. So it's always the X versus Y sort of analysis. You know, why are we doing X versus why are we doing Y?
So bottom line, how much time should people expect to invest in terms of documenting something?
Well, I mean, it's going to depend on what you're actually documenting, but if somebody's spending 3 or 4 hours a day documenting a difficult employee, I think, to be honest with you, that's too much. If it's more like an hour a day over the course of a week, and obviously it's going to depend, too, on a context, like is it a union environment? So if there's a labor union that's involved, obviously documentation is going to be a lot more important, but also then you have to start taking a look at, you know, why are we engaged in so much documentation just to appease a labor union that really doesn't help our profit or help us make more money? And I've had this discussion myself with labor unions. You know, the same transparency that goes into dealing with your employees, I've had that same transparent sort of discussion with the labor union, saying to them, hey, you're not helping us make money. If all you're doing is being a problem, then we may as well just fire the employees, deal with the National Labor Relations Board, and work it out on the back end. So if you want to protect your employees and really engage in meaningful representation of them, then help us make more money by making these employees better.
That sounds so unusual and so dramatically effective. It's kind of like, I'm sure there are some people on this call who like hear you say that and then are like gripped by how amazing that like that could actually be as a possibility.
Well, I think part of it too is that I understand the regulatory environment in dealing with the EEOC or the National Labor Relations Board. Often I take the view that a lot of these governmental regulatory agencies have this do as we say, not do as we do approach. I mean, the National Labor Relations Board is having trouble right now with their own employees who are really, they're getting a lot of blowback from, I guess, field investigators and field attorneys regarding the way they allege that they're treated in the workplace. You see this coming up with, I don't know why this is kind of bizarre dynamic, but you see this a lot now with graduate students too. Like graduate students who are talking, graduate assistants who are talking about unionizing because they feel that maybe they feel that their paper cuts aren't being properly administered to or something along those lines. Because I went to grad school, I was a grad assistant myself, and you know I was happy to be a grad assistant because it's free, you know, it's free money basically to just help out. But now, evidently, there's some changes, some real sea changes in the way people perceive their role in the workplace, whether it's a graduate student, whether it's a manufacturer, a welder, or whether it's a truck driver, cab driver, whatever. So it's just I think you have to pay attention to these issues. Personality, and you brought this up before, Nim, personality, empirically speaking, is one of the biggest predictors of success in the workplace that there is. Studies have been done by the Jevity Institute and Cornell University School of Industrial and Labor Relations, basically indicating that personality is the biggest predictor of success in the workplace. So if it's that important, you know, why are we going to spend a lot of time with somebody whose personality or somebody whose personality we hate or somebody that we just don't like in general? So I think those are very important questions to ask and saying, are we trying to remediate somebody who we just don't like and we never will like? Or are we trying to remediate somebody whose performance is subpar and they're a great guy and we think that by remediating their performance we'll be able to have a valued employee down the line? Or, you know, maybe we'll avoid an outburst of violence, which is, you know, generally the worst case scenario, but it's always something that has to be looked at. It's like, you know, what do you think this employee is capable of? You know, what's the worst you think that they're capable of?
Absolutely. That was really well said. Thank you for, I mean, you really just bottom-lined it, where it's kind of like, do you really see this person as a fit for you, your organization, or their team, or not? And if so, what are you going to do about it? And if not, what do you need to be prepared for?
Yeah, do you want to engage in a long, drawn-out sort of assessment of their personality problems or their issues with us, or is it just better to say to them, hey, I don't think we can, you know, you're just not a good fit for us. Your personality, we just don't like you that much. I've had that discussion with employees I've had that discussion with union representatives where I've said to the union rep, we don't trust you. And, you know, that's why we're engaged. I said that to a union rep at the National Labor Relations Board in front of the NLRB attorney, in front of the union's attorney. I said, my clients just don't trust you. So I think it's very important to get a lot of that type of stuff out of the way Otherwise, it's just these are obstacles that are going to impede any sort of progress.
Yeah, when they're left unsaid and then they're invisible, nothing can be done about them and you only deal with the consequences. When you can air them out and deal with them as visible obstacles, then you actually have the chance to dismantle them.
And then, too, when you understand the regulatory environment such that, you know, like the National Labor Relations Board, they always say outright, and I bring up the National Labor Relations Board, by the way, because they're coming up, they're in trouble. The government is not funding them as much as they'd like to be funded, so they're going after now non-union related issues. You've heard, maybe some of you have heard about the Facebook cases, but I've had non-union not-for-profits who've been gone after by the NLRB in Chicago, and I've seen what the NLRB is capable of doing, you know, shaking up in the workplace. But when push comes to shove, a lot of times, like I said before, these governmental agencies, they don't advise businesses to do as we do. They advise businesses to do as what we say you should do. And frankly speaking, I don't think there's any taxpayer-run organization that's really so efficient that we should be doing, in the private sector, we should be doing as they do, or we should be doing as they say even. So, you know, it's a double standard. And I've said this before, too, to NLRB investigators and to EEOC investigators saying, hey, if we did what you guys would recommend, we'd be bankrupt because no business could run itself that way. And frankly, if you're going to take this type of approach with us, then I'm not going to deal with you on the investigatory level. I'll just deal with your attorneys on the back end because we know that we'll get a better settlement anyway. And we know that we'll be able to cut the cord with a difficult employee, which has happened. So, you know, the NLRB will always say, like, oh, we won't settle a case for less than 80% of back pay, but the truth of the matter is they will if they know that they're pushed, if their backs are against the wall, or if they know that basically, hey, we're just going to pay this money to employees part of a severance. You know, they've been with us for 20 years. They're much more of a problem now than they've, for whatever reason, they've become too much of a problem. So, you know, we'll give them a severance via some sort of back pay settlement at the agency level, as opposed to reinstatement, as opposed to posting notices around the workplace, as opposed to whatever sort of remedy the NLRB or the EEOC or this other governmental authority would like to see us implement.
Great. There's so much that we could talk about this. What are the legal ramifications of, you know, taking certain actions? What's your potential liability? What's the cost of an attorney in some contexts versus others? What about employment practices or their exposure? But we're at time right now. We've spoken for an hour. I'm just wondering, is there any place where they can go to get any other questions that they have that they want answered?
Yeah, I'm happy to follow up if they have some reasonable questions they'd like to toss at me regarding some of these issues. And also, you know, just to remind people, I like to fall back on the sort of street smart way of doing things versus the purely legal compliance way of doing things. So when you're engaging an employee in a discussion, don't be defensive with the employee yourself. Get out from behind the desk, you know, meet with them face to face, maybe take a walk outside the building with them around the corner or something, you know, to get a cup of coffee and talk about some of these issues outside the workplace for about 10 minutes or something, you know, something along those lines. Obviously, you want to be cognizant of whether or not it's a male-female dynamic that's at play or whether there's any allegations or undertones of any sort of bias, protected class bias. So obviously, it's not a good idea to engage an employee outside the workplace for 10 minutes to just grab a cup of coffee if you think that they're going to use that as a weapon against you.
Awesome. I mean, awesome that you're providing really excellent, excellent feedback and advice for people who want to handle difficult or problem employees in the easiest way that's possible in their specific situation.
Yeah, I don't, you know, thanks. And like I said, if it's a matter of time and money versus just dragging out a long, drawn-out, sort of languishing process with a person who's not going to come around, then, you know, let's identify when or where we need to cut the cord and just do it at that point.
Now, if someone wanted to ask you more questions about that, what would be the best way to reach you?
Email or phone. I'm happy to talk with them via email. My email address, I believe, if you just go to charlesakrugel.com, They could contact me via email or phone then. So I'm happy to take any reasonable follow-up questions or discuss some of these types of what we've discussed, tactics or legal concerns with them, with people.
All right, great. And what's the best phone number to reach you?
312-804-3851. That's really my only phone number.
Okay, great. Great. And I also want to extend an offer to the people who are on the call today. And for anybody who will be listening to this recording in the future, we're offering a complimentary 22-point assessment and debrief on team performance and employee effectiveness. We want to make sure that, you know, from us at the Roundwell, that we're supporting you and making sure that you guys are operating at peak performance when it comes to your employees, that they're engaged, that they're happy, that they're loyal, that they don't want to go anywhere else, and that they're really working hard to generate money for your company. And that way everyone, you know, stays happy, stays employed, and is effective in achieving their goals. If you want to register for that complimentary free 22-point assessment and debrief, just shoot me an email, nimrodg@theroundwell.com. That's N-I-M-R-O-D-G @theroundwell.com. And then just type in the subject line, you know, complimentary 22-point assessment, or something referencing this phone call, and I'll be happy to schedule that assessment and debrief with you. Okay, at this point, I think, you know, it'd be great if we can open up the floor to Q&A, if there are any questions that anyone has that haven't been answered. So I'm going to unmute the lines, and just feel free to chime in. Okay, I have unmuted the lines. Does anyone have any questions that we haven't addressed yet? I recognize it's 1:05. We're both willing to stay until 1:15 to make sure that we get all the questions answered.
Nothing, I guess. We've answered everyone's questions.
I have one question, if I may.
Sure.
I think my bigger question comes in where management has not accurately performed the necessary assessments on employee performance over a period of time. So employees become somewhat, I guess, entrenched that the performance that they're bringing out is more than enough. Now you bring in a new manager whose responsibility has been given to reassess all the things because management is not pleased with the employees. And the employees, of course, are going to be very resentful and uncooperative because their chief belief is going to be, hey, I've been doing this job for X amount of time. Here comes the new guy or gal and comes in with all of these ideas. And I've been doing this job just fine for 5, 10, 15 years. How do you then try to positively create a more substantially interesting work area, or just try to change their minds? Basically, you got a big boss over there saying, hey, Jim down there, he's a real nice guy, but he's been doing the job wrong for 15 years. I need him to do the job right or get him out of here.
Yeah, I think you have to have
a... Chuck, do you mind if I take this first?
Yeah. Go ahead.
So the first thing that I'm hearing is that, you know, there's a real difference in context here. I can't remember the last time that someone came up to me and said, you're doing this wrong, you need to change. And I went, sure, no problem. Like, yeah, tell me what I need to do. I've been doing it wrong for 15 years, no big deal. You know, so what I'm hearing is the context that's created when you have a manager approaching an employee in that way, it's a context that immediately creates resentment. Because what you're telling someone is you've been doing it wrong for 15 years.
Right.
Now, that may or may not be the case, you know, but what's effective is having those kind of heart-to-heart conversations, not from a perspective of what's right or wrong,
mm-hmm.
but from a perspective of what's working, what's not working, what can we do better, here's what I'm seeing, are you, you know, how open are you to doing things differently?
Right, and
really,
I think that what I'm coming to, and that's why I understand from the attorney's point of view, is that you have to create a sort of, not that you want to throw everybody out in 5 seconds, but sort of come to a particular point in time because you do try to do it in a positive venue. But that was then. This is now. So you
I think the issue is that the division, the sector, the supervisor, whatever, is costing more money than they're worth.
Right.
And I think you have to have that. I've had that discussion with employees before. I had a really interesting discussion once with a group of child care workers.
Right.
In Chicago who were getting government funding, and the government funding to this program was being cut, and therefore layoffs were going to be necessitated. And the employee said, well, we've never had a problem before. You know, why all of a sudden now is there a problem? And the discussion we had was, you're not and they're also, their performance appraisals were fudged up, basically. I mean, they were kind of inflated because,
okay.
I don't know if their supervisors were afraid of them or whatever, or maybe their supervisors liked them a lot. So, you know, the discussion we had was the incongruency between the performance appraisals they received and the funding that was actually what being cut. How
okay.
could you be performing so well if you're losing money?
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
So, you know, you have to show them where that money comes into play.
Okay.
And I that's one of the big things to me about transparency. I mean, and this generational change that we're seeing now. There's more data and information available about companies. I mean, you could find out, you could go online, find out if the company's been sued for anything else, I'm sorry.
No, you're absolutely correct. And I guess from the employers also, I mean, the world has changed in the last few recessionary years. Salaries that were XYZ at one point are now, ABC less.
Yeah.
And you've got this salary.com that's telling everybody that this is really what the salary structure should be, and yours is nowhere in that area. So, and rightfully so, on certain occasions, employees going to sit there and say, okay, that's fine, but you're going to have to now pay me XYZ dollars in order to bridge that gap, in order to now perform the way you want me to, and the employer may not be able to do that.
Yeah, and the employer then has to be able to explain or articulate to the employee why, because obviously, as an attorney, I deal with this all the time. Like, one of my clients is a fast food restaurant chain, and they have an Equal Pay Act complaint at the Department of Labor brought by a male because the male felt that he was being paid less than his female counterparts.
Okay.
And there's only two other female, three employees total at this one restaurant. And, so how could there be an Equal Pay Act violation if there's only three employees there? And and two women are, was the Equal Pay Act really intended to remedy men being paid less than women on the basis of their performance?
Right. Very interesting, yeah.
So.
Okay.
A lot of these variables come in. I think, maybe my perspective as an attorney, I don't know if I'm able to look at a broader picture or not, but, it's when you have when you deal with these employees who are saying that type or who allege that in a complaint. And that's one thing, too, is that what context did the employee raise this? I mean, if the first place that we've heard about this dispute is from their attorney or from a regulatory agency, then why didn't they come to us beforehand and give us the opportunity to remedy that between us?
Mm-hmm.
And that's always, to me, a signifier. And, you start getting into allegations of retaliation then, but, if an employee goes to their attorney first or goes to an agency first before coming to an employee, does that say something bad about the employee, or does that say something bad about the employer?
Mm-hmm.
Is that saying that the regulatory agency is so much better than any of us that, we need to go to the regulatory agency no matter what?
Right. I mean, and at what point, I guess, as an employer, can you sit down with your employees and say, okay, look, this is the clean slate.
Yeah.
We're going to wipe, and this is the way the job needs to be done in connection with what's out there in the workforce, what's out there in the workplace, and then trying to alleviate the frustration and the anger and the resentment from the employee who's the only view that they have is, I'm being asked to do more and still earn the same amount of money.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's where the importance of having an effective, tough conversation comes in. I mean, what I'm really hearing is, from one perspective, you've got somebody who isn't getting their job the way that it's supposed to be done and the way that it was supposed to have been done for a very long time. And on the other side, you've got the employee who's used to doing it in a certain way, and they're being asked to do more.
In connection with environmental, updates, I mean, I don't know how it's supposed to, at one point in time you can move the widget from left to right and it was okay. But now this is 2012 and the widget can be moved in different directions. And as part of the assumption of that skill set is that that person has to be responsible, responsive to those professional environmental issues. And the person is saying, as you were just saying, forgive me for interrupting, is that, hey, I've been doing this job the right way for 15 years.
That's,
I change
that's,
now.
That's where the acknowledgement of their situation is going to come in. That's where there needs to be some sort of move on the part of management to say, hey, yeah, you're right. Like, this is the way that you've been doing it. And it's worked to the degree that it's worth. And now we're going to, you know, raise our game more.
Okay.
Well, good employees.
Is that something that you're up for?
Yeah, I mean, good employees aren't asked to do less.
Yeah, it's a context shift. It really
yeah.
is. It really
I mean,
is.
If we wanted to treat we could treat everybody like the Japanese executives who get put in the corner space without any windows and, you know, the floor-to-ceiling cubicle-type setup. I mean,
right.
is that what you want? Is that what you're asking for? Is, you know, something like that? So,
right.
you know, I think, from, you know, there's a common sense component to all this, too, that, you know, we're not going to ask you to do less, and we're not going to expect you to do less. We're going to expect you to do more if we think that you're capable of it, or if we think that in the past, for the past 15 years, we haven't gotten the profit or results that we were expecting out of this one sector or department.
Right. Okay.
The key piece that I want to make sure gets communicated is that it's the way that the context gets created for the employee that you're speaking to. So
mm-hmm.
if they view it as something where it's like them being forced to do more when what was working before was totally acceptable, that is not as effective, and it doesn't motivate them to action in the same way that, hey, like, you know, let's step up our game. You know, the way that you did it was totally fine, and now it's time to just, you know, move to the next level. Can you hear the difference in context and how that would impact their resistance to the idea of doing more?
The answer is yes, and I think that it depends, in my particular opinion, on how many years the individual in question has been doing things in a what the – and like I said, I think there's a lot to blame here. The employer did not make it clear what the real role of the individual, of the employee, should be, because the employer didn't know what it was, really. I mean, you know, you hire a new person, and that person has 10 times the amount of skills, and as part of their own dynamic, they're willing to put out all this work. But then you have somebody who doesn't have that skill set, who, you know, doesn't have all of the computer logistics, that doesn't have this, that doesn't have that, and you sit there and say, okay, you know what, maybe I can send this person to class. Resentful. You mean I have to do more? I have to learn more? I have to do this? I have to do that? And as the employer's notes, at one point, and I thank the attorney for giving me this mindset, you can work with the situation and work with the situation, but at one point in time, you have to sit there and say, you know what, I think I need to cut the cord on this,
yeah.
and I'm going to have to try to get rid of this person because obviously we're no good for them anymore.
What I'm hearing is a disconnect in attitude than a person's willingness to be a team player. And that's, you know... That's a concern with an attitude. That's something that can shift for them. That's, again, I'm going to keep pointing to heart conversations as a key piece to that kind of solution. But ultimately, you're 100% right. You know, if they're not moved, then you get very clear about, you know, well, how connected are they to our organization? You know,
right. I thank you very much for the insight. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, are there any other questions? Okay, then I want to, on behalf of myself and Chuck, I want to thank you all for attending the call. This call has been recorded, so I'm going to be sending you a link to the recording that you can download at your own leisure. I believe the download is only going to be available for a certain window of time, but I'll notify you as to that time in an email. And other than that, again, you know, if you have any further questions about the legal aspect of making difficult decisions around a problem or difficult employees, you know, Chuck is, you know, excellent, very knowledgeable, very charismatic. Chuck, you really know your stuff, and it's really, you know, it's really a pleasure working with you on this kind of stuff.
Thanks for the charismatic part.
Of course. You don't know this, but Chuck is feeling under the weather today. But I can assure you, he's excellent, very charismatic, and very, very highly capable. Chuck, do you want to just let them know what your number is again, the best way to reach
sure.
you?
Sure. If you just Google Charles Krugel or Charles, my URL, charlesakrugel.com, and my phone number is 312-804-3851. So I'm really easy to find on the Internet. So.
Great, great. And again, I invite you to schedule your 22-point assessment and debrief on employee effectiveness and performance. The best way to reach me is 732-385-1522. That's 732-385-1522. And you can also go to theroundwell.com. That's theroundwell.com. And contact us and let us know how we can help you. So thank you all very much, and have a wonderful day. Take care.